Welcome to Transmissions, a podcast of the Blackwood Gallery at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. My name is Laura Tibi, and I'm the educator in residence here at the Blackwood. This podcast begins by covering Burning Glass, Reading Stone, a series of exhibitions across four light boxes on the UTM campus, running from September 2020 through June 2021. Although students have returned from their winter break, the campus remains quiet as the city is still under lockdown. Our continued conditions of mediation implore us to reflect on how the current pandemic has reconfigured nearly every aspect of our collective lives, making more apparent the social, economic, and environmental disparities in our world. We can begin by acknowledging the land on which the University of Toronto Mississauga operates, acknowledging that this is stolen, exhausted, and occupied land that has been inhabited, stewarded, and cared for by the Huron-Wendat, the Seneca, and most recently the Mississaugas of the Credit River, and that it continues to be the meeting place and home to Indigenous people from across Turtle Island. This podcast forms one part of our Reader-in-Residence program, featuring the reader and artist in question-driven conversation. The reader will then respond to the image series in the form of a reading, a set of images, a performance, a musical score, or another form of interpretation. In this episode, Reader in Residence Shen Yi will speak with Shahir Zazai to learn about his work featured in part 4 of the Blackwood's Light Box series, titled Is But Will Be. Shahir Zazai is an Afghan-Canadian artist whose practice explores diasporic cultural identity through digital iterations of traditional Afghan carpet patterns. And Shen Yi is an artist, musician, software engineer, and improviser whose work combines sound, code, and movement, often using vocal experimentation and computation as a means to tap into pre-linguistic modes of communicating. Shen and Shahir's conversation is intercepted by some experimental sounds in this episode, which Shen created as a response to Shahir's work. Shen uses a modular synth, a technology that relies on code, to generate these sounds, while Shahir's digital composites remind us that the process of carpet weaving itself is code, relying on specific arrangements of shapes and densities of fabric to create the intended pattern. Shen's sound interpolations are made up of organic and computational mediations to produce a kind of textured, even tactile sound. So in this way, both Shen and Shahir's technologies are centered around code.
So just want to give the audience some context. Right now, Shahir and I are meeting in person at his studio in Toronto.
Both wearing masks and trying to talk through a mask.
Yeah, it's a weird time.
That's thinking about this back to the origin.
Mm-hmm.
What was the initial impulse that makes you start this process?
So the intent wasn't really to make any art or it even becoming an art project. It was more to give myself a task or a challenge, as I like to call it. To type 2013 dots and spaces, just to see what the outcome would be. That's a motorcycle going by. The challenge was mainly because I kept finding myself in front of a laptop, always, just like we all do. And it happened to be January 1st, 2013, which is why 2013 dots and spaces. It was more that I didn't feel achieved, so it was a partial challenge, partial punishment. The end result didn't really feel like much, and from there I tried to expand into a larger amount of text and started playing around with Microsoft Word to see what else I could do with it. And that snowballed to what it has become now.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Welcome to Toronto, where sirens are part of everything.
Yeah, I was also super curious, you know, out of so many different software, why Microsoft Word?
I think it's more, I think the task itself led it to becoming a Microsoft Word as the medium, because I gave myself a task to type, and specifically when it's not intended to be an artwork and I'm not coming to it with the intention of trying to create digital work. I feel like if I thought of it as I'm going to make some digital art, I would have probably been drawn to using Photoshop or Illustrator or InDesign. But I guess the uniqueness of the situation was that the intention was an art. So I wasn't really thinking in that context. So typing, first thing that comes to mind is open a Word document and start typing. And that became the basis of it. And from there on, I stuck with it, not just because that's where I started from, but because using an unconventional art making process creates new challenges in the process itself. So that was entertaining for me, having to troubleshoot a document creating software to try and create imagery out of it. That troubleshooting aspect of it is probably the most exciting part of the process for me.
Just mentioned typing was the very starter of this process, but then later on, like, the audience will associate your digital drawing with carpet.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how you think the relationship between typing in Microsoft Word and weaving a carpet?
I wonder if the audience can hear that. There's a fly in the background. Coming back to this, thank you for your question. The relationship to carpets and textiles. At the end of the day, none of what the outcome or how the audience receives the work was the initial intent. So even the carpet aspect of it, the textile aspect of it, was not something I intended on. It's just where it led to. I think it speaks more to the nature of the process, because it's text, it's color, it's repetition, and there's a lot of numbers involved. I count a lot. There's a method to, like, if I'm making a diagonal line, it goes 1 over, 1 down, 2 over, 1 down, and it's following that numerical order. Because of numbers and repetition, it started creating patterns, and patterns automatically started speaking to textiles. For me, at the beginning, I really boiled it down to it being a subconscious thing, that textile imagery is something I've lived with. We've always had carpets around in the family. When we moved from Afghanistan to Pakistan, from Pakistan to Canada, we always carried our carpets with us. So subliminally, it may have been there, but I fought it for a while as well. When I started noticing that the work was becoming very textile-like, I didn't want it to go in that direction. mainly because I didn't intend it. I didn't intend to be somebody who's going to use a digital medium to create textile-based work. I was not a textile-based artist either. Neither was I an artist who was working based on his culture and traditions. So all those factors combined, because the intention wasn't there, I tried to fight it, and I tried to avoid it as much as possible. So for a big while, one, I was not showing the work, and I was not comfortable putting it out there. At the same time, I tried to make it look like something else. I tried to do whatever it took to make it non-textile-like. But at the end of the day, the process mimics carpet knotting techniques so much that there was an unavoidable factor of, like, that's what the medium and the work wants to be over what I would like it to be. And whatever I wanted it to be was mainly to avoid not falling in the bracket of an artist who's working based off their culture and history. So that was just an internal battle till I had to accept it, that that's where the work was going. And that acceptance came around the time I did my residency at OCAD for Digital Painting Atelier, which is where I brought my intent in. And the intent at that point was to make a life-size carpet by typing it over a span of 40 hours, because the residency was 1 week long, 1 week meaning 40 hours of work. So I took 40 hours and I typed and improvised the design to create a life-size carpet. And I feel like that's the process mimics carpet weaving so much that naturally that's where it was leading.
Right. Yeah, that really leads to the question, because you just mentioned improvisation. It's part of your process. And a lot of these challenges with, you know, the tool like Microsoft Word, or, you know, the fact that it started to look like carpet, like, like, how do you work with this kind of, you know, aleatory, like, chance, like, that's unknown to you?
Mm-hmm. It's the most fun part of it, because I'm not giving myself, like, I don't plan my designs, I don't sketch them out. The only decisions that I make before the work starts is, or at least I used to, at the beginning of this project, before I get into that aspect of how it's intuitive, at the beginning of this project, I used to apply a lot of rules to my work. There were set dimensions, there were set symmetry that I had to follow. And something that I learned around the time when I did the residency is that carpet designs are based on garden designs. So I would have that subconsciously in my head as well. So all those factors combining was making everything very symmetrical. Carpets are very symmetrical. So I was applying those rules to it. So things that I start with is how big of a work I'm going to make. That defines how many Microsoft Word pages do I need to use to make the work. And then what colors am I going to use? I mean, Microsoft Word has a limit of 15 colors, and that includes black and white. So I used to pick 4 colors and then just play with it. And the troubleshooting, or the intuitive aspect of it, or the improvised aspect of it, comes from it's purely playing Tetris. It's every shape that I place on a page limits how much room I'm left with on the page. And then it's somehow squeezing in the next shape next to that one. And by doing that one after the other, it slowly fills up the page. And the more the page gets filled up, the less room I'm left with. So it's almost like with every action, I'm making it more difficult for myself to comfortably do something else after. So the more challenging it gets, the more exciting it gets. And that improvisation and troubleshooting and responding to every action I've made before it is pretty much what creates the design and how the work comes about.
Then I'm curious, do you ever go back?
Pretty much never, unless I notice a problem. And problem meaning, like, I left something unhighlighted. Like, I missed something along the way. I'll edit in that way. But speaking of editing, actually, when I first started this project, I used to delete my files just to not give myself that option to be able to edit. So I used to make the work, take a screenshot of it, and then delete the files so that I can't edit. So all these parameters and rules that I would apply on it pretty much was so that it's just you start and you finish, you don't go back and edit anything. I was also coming from a painter's perspective, that when you're making a painting, you've rendered something, you're done with it, you move on. Of course, there's always the option to edit, but I always chose not to. Again, self-imposed rules.
Yeah, yeah, like, it seems like, you know, obviously it starts from a rule-based logic, but after a certain point, you started to leave it to chance, or your intuition, or other parameters you set to yourself. How do you see this, like, pull and push? Like, do you find it as a challenge to deal with, or you feel like it's feeding you more inspiration? Or
I think it's more that it feeds the process, and it feeds it's much more in an inspiration and an excitement than it is a challenge that would stop me from doing it. I guess it's my nature. The more the challenge, the more that I have to solve. And that's exciting. It's exciting to have something to troubleshoot. Or if it's, I don't even know how to put this. It's like, it's, if there's an obstacle, how do you get around it? Finding new ways to get around it, that's exciting for me, over having an image in my hand and just making it. Because if I had any preconceived images that then I just output, this would have become quite boring for me and I would have given up long time ago. But I think it's the aspect that I don't know what's going to happen. I can start a work, I can have a rough idea of, okay, this is the direction I'd like to take it. But almost like 99% of the time, things happen along the way that I did not foresee.
Can we talk a little bit more about, like, the phase when early on where you have this compulsion to make work that's symmetrical?
These are all realizations that have come much later on. Like I said, I don't like thinking about what I'm doing when I'm doing it. So much later on, I realized that these are things that have come out in conversations during studio visits, things that have come to light to me, is that the symmetry and the rules and the restrictions that I applied to my work was very much how I was living. I'm born in Afghanistan and I've lived in Pakistan for 13 years and then now in Canada for almost 15, or it has been 15. But because of all this movement and constantly having to experience a change where you have to readjust and resettle yourself, that I don't recall ever being a child. Like, as a child, I feel like I was always an adult. And I think a lot of that comes from always being in a state of alert, always being ready for the next challenge that you might have to experience. And the challenge can be simple things like you're changing neighborhoods, you're changing schools, you're changing countries. And it's always being ready to adjust to new. As a result, it creates a state of mind where you're so on alert that you have to be like there's no room for error. There's no room for error, almost like psychologically, physically, socially, and in your interactions, in everything you do. As long as you're awake, there's no room for error. So it was interesting to realize this much later on, that I was applying the same rules to my practice. I was doing what I was doing to myself, also to my work. As a result, my work was so symmetrical, so controlled, that I would go back before considering the work complete. I would go through every character that I've highlighted and typed to check I didn't miss anything. And when I'm stitching the pages together, I would go down to the pixel state of the image to make sure that there's nothing left that somebody could see as a problem. But at the end of the day, it was just me seeing them. Nobody else ever walked up to the work and said, hey, there's something not right here. Everybody received it really well. So once I reached that realization, I think, again, subconsciously, without intending it, there became a need for a change. And that change became allowing for errors to exist and allowing for non-symmetry to come about. And that was almost like breaking out of a shell, breaking out of a boundary that I'd set for myself, and pushing the work to become new on its own as well, which is, I guess, where I am now. The work is evolving. It's becoming stranger. I've been told I use this word a lot. Weirder. So, and that's, again, exciting. I at some point when I was making the symmetrical works, I used to think that will there come a day where I'm like, I've run out of designs and I can't make anything new anymore? I'm going to start repeating myself. But with this change, I feel like it's going to keep evolving. And it's exciting.
It's interesting, like, to me, I can't stop making the analogy between, like, human and machine in this process. Mm-hmm. It's like, when you give parameters, if you, set out, like, control, it's such a machinic task. But as, you know, computer science evolves and develops, and now we have algorithms that are generative, even convolutional. The algorithm will evolve itself so that the machines or the machinic objects that are like using the algorithm will also evolve.
Yeah, it's interesting how what you're referring to, where the generative algorithms will repair itself almost. It will repair itself and it will evolve to be able to outdo what it couldn't do before. Yeah, and it's pushing boundaries. And it's interesting that something like a human sitting in front of a computer using Microsoft Word, and because of the repetition of it, it has done that very mechanical or computerized. It's mirroring that whole algorithm thing that you're talking about, but it's doing it to me, where the work is evolving, but not only is the work evolving, it's changing me by its evolution. I feel like my whole entire perspective has changed because of this project. Before I started making digital work, the lens that I would look at my own culture and my own history was a very negative lens, or focused on all the negative of where I come from, of Afghanistan's history and its culture. And the media fuels that even further, especially when you're sitting so far away from your home country, and then the only information input you have about your home country is media, and the media is very focused on war and the hardships that's going on. So when you're at a distance, you're already looking at everything from a very critical perspective, and then on top of that, media is feeding you negative. You can really go deep into this negativity. And that's where I was at before this project started for me. And over the span of this project, I've gone from that person to someone who became less negative oriented, but more curiosity oriented about my culture. And almost like gone from that to curiosity to research, to wanting to change the lens that others now see my culture from, through, I guess. And now the transformation that I'm able to see in myself, I pretty much give all the credit to the digital work. And simultaneously, I'm seeing the change happen in the work. So I guess to look at it from a very romantic perspective, the artist and its medium are like mirrors of each other. One changes the other, and the reflection of it happens in the work, or you become the reflection of your work. So the two go hand in hand, and the evolution of it goes hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's this constant feedback going on as well. Mm-hmm. Like you just mentioned, like perception of information, mm-hmm. right? Like, can you talk a little about the new work you make for Blackwood, which like in our previous studio visit, you mentioned it's, you think about information a lot.
Yeah, so when I was first approached for this, for the project for Blackwood Gallery, I wasn't thinking exactly what I was gonna do. It was more that I was thinking on the basis of information I had at the time. So at the beginning, the information I had was there's four light boxes. And I was like, okay, if light boxes, that kind of falls right in the middle of the two ways my work exists. One, it exists on a screen, and it exists in a print form. And a light box is a print on a light screen. So it's almost like the exact middle ground between a computer screen and a print. So that's where I was thinking from. So I got very curious. I was like, okay, this would be really exciting to be able to use existing works and see it in a light box format on that scale, especially 6 foot by 9 foot. But because all my existing works wouldn't have fit those parameters or those dimensions, that I had to consider making new work. And what this project did over the span of working on it, that it broke a lot of my rules. I had rules such as I would not copy paste ever. I will not use the same text from one work to create another work out of it. But when I started working for this project, also the palette I used was not a palette I would have used before. So there was a lot of new things that the project itself was doing. And as for the information that I was keeping in mind, for me it's a 6 foot by 9 foot light box. So what do those two numbers mean for me in this context? It's 6 and 9. So I played with the font size of 6 and 9 in Microsoft Word. So I used every two characters on the main design is a different font size. So the first two are 6, the next two are 9. And then that repeats throughout the work. And then I played with that, and the base of the work is those two font sizes, and I created the entire work out of that. So that in itself, also what I normally used to do prior to this project is I always use monospace characters, meaning characters that occupy the same amount of space on the page. And as a result, I would always use the same font size throughout the design because I didn't want any unexpected changes to happen. But in this context, because I'm purely experimenting, it was fun to use two different font sizes. I know this sounds so such a simple thing to do, but it really changed a lot in what I was producing. And then to work for that dimension and that scale was a challenge of its own. And the work, I mean, it looks somewhere between the carpet work or the symmetrical work I used to make and the non-symmetrical work that came after it. It's almost like the two existing at the same time, almost like layers. And from there, the other rule that I broke was that the copy-paste aspect. So what I decided to also, the theme of the exhibition being a burning glass and a reading stone, I hope I remember that in the correct order. It made me, honestly, when I first read it, Burning Glass, Reading Stone, I was not thinking about a lens. I was stuck in the poetic wording of the exhibition. So I didn't really think of a lens till it dawned on me one day that what they're talking about is a lens. And that started, and I was already in the midst of working on this project, that factor started influencing the work. So I started thinking about what happens to information when it goes through a lens. And for me, that lens is the parameters that I set for the work. So the first work I made was based on the 6 and 9 font size. The following works was me changing those parameters. So for the next work, I took the entire text and I changed the font size to 9 for the whole thing. And that stretched it, but it somehow maintained the design. And then in the following, I changed the font size on every line. So the first sentence being all 9, the next sentence all being 6. So I played around with that. So it was an experiment to see what happens to information when you pass it through a lens or you pass it through a filter and what the outcome would be. And that became the basis of what I ended up making for Blackwood Gallery. And the final work was made out of copy-pasting every sentence and removing the enter, I guess, on a keyboard when you press enter and then you go to the next sentence. So to keep the design very legible, I had to do that. But for that last one, I decided that I'm just going to copy paste the text without making sentences out of it. It was just like putting everything one after the other. And that shifted the entire thing and turned it into almost like a gibberish. So it was a lot of fun, to put it simply. It was a lot of fun to play with that information and constantly change parameters and see what the outcomes would be.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
when we talk about lens or filter, we could also think about it as the algorithm or the rule. For this new work, it's like their variation of each other.
Yep, they are variation of each other. It's also, I mean, for me, when I think about lens, there's one that there's the literal lens, the glass that you hold that you can look through and it skews things for you. In the context of the exhibition's title, the lens can burn something because of the way the light is being focused on one point, or it can magnify what you're reading. But outside of that, from my practice perspective, or from the lens that I make work through, it has a lot to do with the curiosity towards what cultural identity really means. And then the lens that the audience brings to the table. So I make work and I put it out there, but the way people receive it is not what I have intended it to be. A lot of the times, well, majority of the time, that's how it goes, is that people see it from a different lens than I have intended it to be. So it's interesting. It's raised this whole question for me in my practice, is that, is cultural identity even, does it even exist the way we perceive it? Is it a fixed point? Does it constantly transform based on who's holding the lens and who's looking through it? Who's feeding the information through it? So for me, being an Afghan alone is a very strange concept to think about, because there's the Afghan that I'm born, then there's the Afghan that I've lived at home with my family, then there's the Afghan you live when you come across other Afghans, and then there's the Afghan that people see you as. So every person brings in their own parameters that they apply to you. So your identity is constantly transforming based on who's looking at it.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you said. Like when people define, you know, the term like information, because information, it's literally is supposed to be neutral, but there's also message. Message is not neutral.
It's a translation of the information.
Yeah. And like you said, perception. Well, there's perception that will alter the meaning, but there's also the medium, right, will also alter it. There's so many layers of that. And yeah, like your process, and especially the new work, it shows.
Thank you for listening to Transmissions, a podcast of the Blackwood Gallery. The Blackwood Gallery gratefully acknowledges the support of the Canada Council for the Arts, the Ontario Arts Council, and the University of Toronto Mississauga. New episodes are released with each new image set between September 2020 and June 2021. For more information, including installation images, essays, and videos, visit the Blackwood website at blackwoodgallery.ca. Thank you.